Hello and welcome to the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. My name is Andrew Dalbo. I'll be here with Josh and Henry discussing all the good and bad about Arsenal Football Club. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome to episode 28 of the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. My name's Andrew. I'm here with Josh, but we are missing one of our key components. Unfortunately, Henry's got a busy week on with work, so he can't join us today. But Josh, how are you doing?
Doing good. I'm just getting over being sick. I get sick like twice a year, and it just happened to come this past weekend. So,
oh dear.
Doing good aside from that.
Yeah, one of my friends has also just been sick, and he just took holiday, which always seems to happen. You always take holiday and then get ill, and then never actually enjoy your time off. But there we go. Sod's law, isn't it? Thankfully, we come to you on Tuesday afternoon after Arsenal won again. They can't stop winning. I read somewhere this is their fifth successive win, which is quite frankly astonishing given that they were so poor for so long. But there we go. It was quite an entertaining game. 3-2 win against Southampton. Lots of controversy. A few refereeing decisions that may or may not have gone Arsenal's way. Some good goals, some truly terrible defending. There wasn't much it didn't have, to be fair. What did you make of it? Did you enjoy it, I guess, like the rest of us?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I guess from the positive side of looking at things, if Arsenal's going to be, you know, riddled with porous cracks in their defense, at least it's entertaining from a viewing yeah. perspective, and it forces the attack to make something happen, so can't yep, complain
goals,
too much.
Goals are good, no yes. matter what end they go in. I mean, the Stoke game, for example, was so utterly dull.
Yes.
Even though Arsenal actually won by a bigger margin in the end than this game, I kind of preferred this game just because at least something happened. You know, we hit half-time, I was like, oh, actually, at least things have happened. It might not have been... Might not have all been good, but at least stuff has happened. I guess the biggest news story at the moment in the last few days is probably centred around Henrik Mkhitaryan. He suffered some form of knee issue. Do you know what it is exactly?
They said it was ligament damage, but they don't know how bad it was or how bad it
right.
is. Estimation was that it would be, I mean, like you say, he listed all the games that he'd be out for, but it's sounding like it's a race to get him back before the end of the season, which is mildly troubling.
Yeah, I would be surprised if we see him possibly not until the Europa League final.
I'm hoping maybe. He'll be back for that, especially, or hopefully, it means we'll dodge Atletico Madrid in the next round. But
yeah, that really, I mean, we've seen this with Arsenal injuries before, where they say, oh, it'll only be a couple of weeks, and 2 years later, they're still injured. So it wouldn't be surprising if Mkhitaryan misses all of next season at this rate, but hopefully he'll be back later in the year. Obviously, the Premier League games, I don't think he would have played on Sunday anyway.
Right.
And really, they don't really matter, so him missing them is not that big of an issue. But certainly, the four remaining Europa League games, one of which will hopefully be a formality, but the other three are huge games. If he misses two of them, then that could be extremely detrimental to Arsenal's season. How do you think Wenger will deal with his absence, both in the Premier League and the Europa League? And we'll get on to the CSKA game in particular, but let's say he misses the whole season between now and the end of the year. How do you think Wenger will deal with those problems?
I guess it's a good thing in the Premier League because, I mean, he probably wouldn't have played many more Premier League games regardless, but it certainly guarantees that Reece Nelson will be in the picture more, which is what we all mm-hmm. wanted before the end of the year. And if it's true that he's close to signing a new contract, this will do a lot towards helping him push him over the edge for that. As far as the Europa League, I mean, that's the tough one because he was such a big part of that playing opposite Ozil. You got to kind of consider who you'd rather have in there because your choices really are just Iwobi or Welbeck, which is kind yeah. of frightening because I think of the two most criticized players at Arsenal, it would be those two and Granit Xhaka, of course. But I mean, I don't know. I guess it just depends on who the opponent is because they both bring such different things to the table and such inconsistencies that it's hard to to really bank on one to be able to fill what Mkhitaryan was doing. But I don't know, I guess if I had to choose, I would choose Welbeck. But I think we'll talk more about that later when we talk about the upcoming Moscow game.
Yeah, I do wonder if, because he's kind of played with these four rotating centre midfielders in the Europa League in terms of Mkhitaryan, Ozil, Wilshere and Ramsey. And I wonder if he wants to try and stick with that kind of, because it won't be less so, but certainly Welbeck, they're very different to Mkhitaryan. Welbeck's far more of a burner, he's an athlete really, whereas Mkhitaryan's more of this kind of floating player who wants to drift between the lines of the game, whereas Welbeck's quite happy to run in behind and he's a bit more powerful, but he's a different player. And I wonder if Wenger wants to continue with this more kind of nuanced, creative manner, and that may see Jack Wilshere pushed into a more advanced position, and then an Elneny come into the midfield and Granit Xhaka perhaps pushed into a box-to-box role that he has played at times more recently. I don't know, I'm only spitballing, but that may be something that Wenger wants, because he wants those three or four players in behind the central striker who are all extremely comfortable on the ball and are all extremely comfortable in switching positions and have a great fluidity of movement between one and the other. We will find out in due course, but it is a possibility.
I like that idea better than mine. That's a good call. I like the idea of putting Elneny back in there next to Xhaka and pushing Wilshere forward.
Yes. Well, speaking of Elneny, he was involved in quite the controversy at the end. Obviously, Jack Stevens and Jack Wilshere got into a little bit of a fight. We'll get into that in due course. Then Elneny came charging in, and I kind of missed what happened live. And even watching many replays, I'm still not quite sure what happened.
Because nothing happened.
Yeah, but basically what I can figure out is, even though Stevens had been sent off, Southampton were about to take the ensuing free kick. Elneny then goes up to one of their players and kind of gently pushes him. And I think he did it to maybe another one or another two. And the referee just doesn't like him, so sent him off. That's basically what I can deduce from this situation. I don't really know what he did. I don't know why he did it. I don't know why it constituted a red card. For me, it was maybe a yellow card at best. But there we go. That's what happened. I guess the biggest problem for Arsenal is that Elneny was one of those key members of depth in the Premier League to provide rest for the likes of Wilshere and Ramsey and Xhaka, obviously not this weekend but the weekend prior. Do you think that Wenger may have a trick up his sleeve in terms of trying to still rest those players, or do you think he now just plays them all the way through the Premier League for the next three games?
I hope, and I wrote about this on the site, I hope that his solution doesn't involve Ramsey or Wilshere, just because their injury histories are so clear in our heads that, and it always seems to come from them having to play too much. I would hope that his solution is to turn to Joe Willock, because we haven't seen much of Willock this year, but every time he plays, he seems to have that Elneny quality where he's not really going to do much to impact the game, but he's just a presence there, and he knows he's intelligent with the ball. And I mean, if you're going to give Reece Nelson the chances, why not Willock? I mean, this opportunity is right there. It's not like we're playing for anything in the Premier League, so just give him the chance and see if he can, you know, prove something before the end of the season. I just really hope that whatever he has in mind doesn't involve stretching Ramsey and Wilshere's involvement, because that's the last thing we need, is to see one of them get hurt.
Yeah, no, I agree. I thought the very same thing about Ainsley Maitland-Niles as well. Maybe he may get a run out in midfield, but Wenger has this weird kind of pride thing with the Premier League where he just kind of likes to win Premier League games, even if they don't actually matter, and I have a fear that he may end up just running Wilshere and Ramsey into the ground a little bit here. That Xhaka, Wilshere, Ramsey trio in midfield, I wonder if he just plays them every single game between now and the next few weeks, which is not something that I would be a fan of really, but it wouldn't actually surprise me that much if that's what happened.
He's been good about keeping Ozil and Mkhitaryan too before his injury out of the Premier League though. So I mean,
that's true.
You're right about Wenger having these strange fancies that don't seem to make any sense, but he does lately at least, he's proven that he can learn, and that, I hope that this is one of the things that he's learned, that you just can't stretch Ramsey and Wilshere out that much, at least not yet, until they prove something else.
No, that's true. And I do wonder as well if maybe Lacazette and Aubameyang get a run out in attack, meaning that Wenger has to play one less central midfielder so he can play Xhaka, who is seemingly able to play quite a lot of minutes without it really affecting him. Maybe he plays Xhaka with one of Ramsey or Wiltshire, whoever's feeling the better of the two, with the other one on the bench. And then you can play Aubameyang out wide, you can play Lacazette up front, and then you can play Reece Nelson or Iwobi or Welbeck or even Ozil or whoever you want in there. That's another option to maybe limit the number of minutes that Wilshere and Ramsey in particular are getting over these next few weeks. Because the rhythm of the season now really begins to pick up. Arsenal missed a couple of games earlier in the league. Again, I think it was the Leicester game.
Yeah.
So they've got a midweek game there. They'll have midweek games in the Europa League as well. So, assuming they qualify, obviously. So really, the next month or so is where there's going to be quite a lot of fixtures, and it will be demanding on players' bodies to be able to play every single week. Wenger himself said that some of the players looked a bit tired towards the end, said their legs were heavy. He specifically pointed out Bellerin, and I think Mustafi he pointed out.
Yeah.
Saying that they looked tired with heavy legs, which is perfectly understandable at this point of the season. Both of those players have played a lot of games, and that means that they need to be carefully managed, which we will see if Wenger is capable of doing or not. I have my doubts. The other controversy that happened just before Elneny and his red card was Stevens and Wiltshire. What did you make of that fracas?
I don't know. I found it interesting. I always love when Jack Wilshere starts something. I feel like it's just part of who he is, and if he goes too long without it, he gets dull. So he just kind of has to start something every so often. And the best part about this, I was telling you this before we started recording, was I love that he did it right in front of Siad Kolasinac, because that's exactly who you want on your side if you're going to start a fight yeah. on the pitch. And he was right there. But, I mean, I don't know. This is just what Wilshere does. And the fact that he escaped with the yellow, it's just – and the other guy gets a red, of course, Jack Stevens does. It's just beautiful. I mean, it reminds me of whenever he headbutted Marwan Fellaini in the chest, and he didn't even get a card. He just got told to stop doing what he was doing. He always sneaks out of these things. And I don't know. I mean, obviously, I think there's a lot of frustration with Wilshere. But it's hard to say that because this is something he's always done. It's just part of who he is. So I never really question his fracas starting. I just kind of enjoy it while it's happening.
Yeah, I actually quite like it. I wrote a piece afterwards saying that actually this kind of fight, this bite, this kind of metal is good for this team because, you know, let's be honest, it's been something that they've been desperately absent of for many, many years. And Arsenal have continually been criticised for lacking that kind of winning edge. Well, actually, Jack Wilshere has that, and he has that in spades. And sometimes it certainly goes too far. This is a prime example, and Fellaini's another example. But he does have that little bit of a... he's not afraid to fight, basically. And even though he's a little guy, it is nice to see in a very soft-centred Arsenal team that often will shy away from the battle of if another team is fronting up and being really physical and really getting in their faces, Arsenal don't like it. And Walsh is not afraid to be a bit confrontational. And, it's no surprise that Kolasinac was the first guy there because he also has that kind of the willingness to fight, essentially, which is really quite important. Having said that, Wilshere has not been in good form recently. It's probably a month or two, really, since he's played well. But especially the last two games, I'll give you a couple of stats. He has averaged just 71.5% pass completion rate in the last two games. He completed just one of his four dribble attempts against CSK Moscow on Thursday. He was dispossessed a massive four times against Southampton, which is more than any other Arsenal player. And he only played 27 minutes, which is not good. So this is a player really who's just not playing very well. And for all my love for him, I really like him as a player. he's just not doing very well at the moment, and it is a little bit concerning, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this is one of those things that's actually incredibly one-dimensional. I mean, I can't help but think that a player that's so run by his emotions, that not getting the contract he wants from his team and having them ask him for a pay cut, essentially, is weighing on his head. I mean, it has to weigh on his head. I don't see what else could explain this all of a sudden turn whenever he's really trying to establish himself again. And all of a sudden, all these reports come out, and he's made all these quotes about his contract situation, and then his performances go down the tube a bit. So, I mean, I until this resolves itself, I don't know what we can expect to change with him. I mean, he's always got that fight in him, so I wonder if he will try to dig deep and find a bit more. But it's not easy to do whenever you're at this club that you spent your whole life at. And, I mean, I have no idea what he actually thinks about it, but I have to imagine he feels just a bit disrespected and not appreciated, maybe. And that's the kind of thing that can really, whether you want it to or not, weigh on yourself in your subconscious and prevent you from being the best you can be.
Yeah, that's quite possible. And I wonder if he starts thinking about his future away from Arsenal and starts maybe thinking about, well, actually, this isn't going very well and I'm not very happy here and I don't really feel that they value me like I believe I'm valued. Maybe it's better that I now go and get a bit of a refreshing landscape, a bit of a new team, a new manager to work under. I think that would actually possibly help him quite a lot. I think Wenger's been brilliant for him, but sometimes hearing the same voice over and over again can become a little bit monotonous, a little bit tiring, and it doesn't have the same invigorating effect on a player's game. And I wonder if Wiltshire's reached that point with Wenger now. No, go on, sorry.
No, I was just going to say it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, like you said, you need to have another opinion in your life sometimes. And I'm sure there's plenty of coaches at Arsenal that have offered him opinions. But like you said, it's been 20 years of the same thing for him. So eventually you got to consider if a change-up isn't the best thing.
Yeah. I would be sad to see him go because, wow, he looks like he's lost that kind of first step that he used to have. I still perhaps naively believe that he can get back to somewhere close to what his potential was. And if you can keep him for $100,000 a week, then I think that's worth doing because you're going to have to replace him and it'll probably cost, a replacement will cost at least 20, 30 million really in today's market. Why not just keep Wilshere and see if he's got anything left in the tank? We were at this stage almost every single year with Van Persie and suddenly he hits 27 and gets 18 months of real full fitness and he turns into an outstanding player. I'm not saying the same thing will happen with Wilshere, but maybe Arsenal deserve to at least give him a chance to be able to prove that that's possible. It remains to be seen. Another poor aspect of Arsenal's performance from Sunday was their defending. We'll start with Mustafi and Cech and the first goal. What did you make of it? Who do you put the blame on and where do you think we go from here?
I understand that it was probably Mustafi's responsibility to cover that ball. That said, I think it's just, and maybe I'm just a Mustafi apologist, but I think it's just a little bit unfair to say it was 100% Mustafi. Cech had nothing to do with it. Because, I don't know, maybe, I mean, from Mustafi's point of view, maybe out of the corner of his eye, he saw Cech coming. Maybe he took a step forward and he thought, okay, well, Cech's going to come claim it. And he backed off just for a second. And in the Premier League, that's all you need to give the opponent. They're going to find the space. I mean, that's, I would still place it, I would say 70-30 on Mustafi. But I just want it to be known that it was not 100% Mustafi's fault. Yes, he could have done more, but there are so many factors that could have weighed on his decision to let Cech have a go at it that maybe you can't necessarily blame Cech for entirely. I mean, if he took one false step or if he's taken those balls before, I don't know. I have a hard time completely blaming Mustafi.
That's true. The main issue I have is I want a defender to be decisive and to be aggressive.
I was going to say, but Mustafi normally is. That's why I don't think this was entirely his fault.
Yeah, no. He usually is, and that's very true. But in this situation, positionally he was perfect. He was stood right in the ideal position. He knew where Shane Long was just behind him. He could intercept the cross, apparently ideally, but he didn't. because what he didn't do is essentially take on the responsibility of himself and said, this is my responsibility to go and clear this ball. He allowed it to come into the six-yard box and essentially said, I'm going to put the responsibility on somebody else and I'm not going to stand up and be countered. That's essentially the decision he made. And I would rather a centre-half come and be firm and be sure and be decisive and say, actually, I'm going to deal with this because I'm the central defender and I'm just going to come and clear it. And sometimes that, if Cech's giving him a shout or something, then I completely understand. That's very different. But even if Cech's made a movement to that ball, Mustafi should know that he can clear that without a problem and he should just go and do it, irrespective of whether Cech's coming for it or not.
No, that's fair enough. I do think we have to also consider that last time Mustafi tried to get a ball that Cech was also trying to get, he got absolutely destroyed by Petr Cech. So, I mean, obviously this was a different kind of ball, but I wonder if that was in his mind as well as he looked at that ball thinking, well, Cech's right behind me. I don't want to get taken out by this giant behind me again. So,
No, that's not completely unreasonable. It's probably quite possible that he was thinking about that. And the thing that happens with that situation really is that even if the keeper and centre half clash, one of them should be able to still sweep it up. So let's say Cech does go for the ball, either he gets there first and he collects it and there's no problem, or Mustafi gets there first and he clears it, or they get there at the same time and they kind of bundle it clear collectively. But either way, the ball gets met and they're both aggressive in their defending. The problem is, and this is both of them, but especially Mustafi, they both sat back. They both literally took a step back from the ball rather than going towards the ball. And Shane Long's such a sharp striker. He's a terrible goal scorer, but he's such a quick mover in the penalty box that if you give him that, like you said, if you give him that half a second to nip in front of a defender, he's not going to turn it down. And from that position, he 9 times out of 10, he's going to score that goal. So for me, it was just a lack of decisiveness and a lack of confidence almost in his own ability, which is odd because you're right in saying that Mustafi is usually a very, maybe not sure-handed, but he's a very a front-footed defender. He's quite happy to go and win the ball high up the pitch. And sometimes it's actually a major issue of his. In this situation, he kind of did the opposite. He went into a really conservative approach, which was unusual for him and also a little bit troubling for the future. Unfortunately for Arsenal, it wasn't the only moment of fairly poor defending. There were others. I don't think Callum Chambers had a great game, really. He was absolutely skinned for the second goal. And there were other moments where he really struggled. I don't think Mustafi was very good for much of it. And it just didn't look very connected and very organised.
I will say on that second goal, I watched it a bunch of times just because I've been defending Callum Chambers so much lately. And he did get skinned. And that's usually a situation. And this was another thing with like Mustafi. It was unlike him because he's usually very good in that situation. But that said, I don't know how much responsibility you place on defenders to get back and defend, but you seem to blame Xhaka a lot for that. So I want to point out that Jack Wilshere saw that run and just peeled off and let it go. And he kind of just left Chambers high and dry to handle it himself, and it didn't work out. Now, obviously, it's Chambers' job to clean that up, and he didn't do a good job, but I think he did kind of get set up and stranded when he didn't need to be.
Yeah, no, I don't think you're wrong there at all. And obviously, I think the marking of Austin was pretty shocking as well. You just can't leave a striker on his own in the six-yard box when you've got a fullback on the right wing herring towards the byline. If you're Mustafi, if you're Bellerin, if you're Elneny, who can't quite remember everybody who was in that box, but if you're one of those players, you have to switch on. You have to know that this ball is going to come into the box and you've got to get in front of the striker in front of you. And Austin had nobody in front of him. He just tapped it in. It was just very poor defending. And there were other moments. There was one moment where, obviously, Shane Long's goal that was ruled offside rightly, Arsenal didn't look very aware to the danger. Then there was a moment quite early on where Shane Long got in behind and as soon as he touched the ball was ruled offside, but he was quite clearly onside, and Chambers and Mustafi had no idea where he was at all. And there were a number of moments, especially from crosses, which Arsenal have always been terrible from crosses. But there are a number of moments where the commentator would said Arsenal are, the old cliche, they're at sixes and sevens, which may have been a little bit harsh, but actually it kind of got the message across quite clearly was that Arsenal were not defending well at all. They just looked extremely disjointed and unorganised. And it's not just one player's fault, it's the collective shape, the collective instruction that each of them have got as being a component, as a part of the whole machine, and none of them were doing their job, and consequently they looked very, very lost for large portions of that game. It was extremely concerning.
I will say it was concerning, but this right now is the anomaly, because the Chambers-Mustafi pairing has actually been really good lately, and I still think our best defensive showing of the season was against Chelsea when we had Mustafi holding in Chambers in a back three. So I'm not terribly worried about it yet. Maybe I'm being naive about this because we have had defensive problems all year. But maybe it was just a game where they just really struggled to settle in. And, I mean, Shane Long's that kind of striker who's just really annoying and always making you stay sharp, because he's always going to be pushing the issue, even if he's offsides most of the time. It's still I mean, obviously, I don't want my defense to be troubled that much by people like Shane Long, but I don't know. I'm not terribly worried about it. I hope that next time out we'll see them return back to what we've been seeing lately.
I hope so. I think you asked me why I'm not quite convinced on Chambers, and the main issue is consistency for me, which is probably the most important trait of any defender, especially a centre half. It's just being consistent. And you're right, Arsenal against Chelsea on a couple of occasions this year defensively have been very, very strong. Against Stoke, I thought they were pretty good defensively. I thought Chambers and Mustafi played well. Against AC Milan defensively, I thought they played well in the first leg. Even against CSKA Moscow, defensively, for the majority of the game, they were pretty good. There were moments where the goal was really poor defending, but actually, especially in the second half, they weren't that bad. But then they have these games kind of spluttered throughout the year, like this one, where they just look utterly lost. They look like they don't know what they're doing, really. And that may not be the player's fault necessarily. It isn't especially Mustafi or Chambers' fault that they don't know what they're doing. It might be that their instruction is so poor from Wenger, or that they don't understand what their role is within the whole defensive scheme. That's why they're struggling so much. It isn't necessarily that they are bad players. And actually, Mustafi and Chambers are good examples, because in terms of their traits, they do have everything that you'd want in a defender. They're quick, they're strong, they're good in the air, they're intelligent, they're pretty good on the ball, especially Chambers. But they just have these games every now and then where they just really look like lost sheep, really. They really look like they don't know what they're doing, which is somewhat troublesome. But I guess, moving forward, if they can begin to put a run of games together that is consistent, then maybe we can start to say that they could anchor the Arsenal defence for the next few years. Certainly age wise they have that ability. Final thing I want to touch on about this Southampton game, a bit more positive this time, is the Aubameyang goal streak. He's kind of doing something quite sensational, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. And he's doing it kind of quietly, honestly. Like he's a very, and when you look at him, you just think this is a superstar guy. All of his qualities scream one of the best strikers out there. And I mean, he's just pitching in one or two goals every game, and he's not touching the ball that much. He's not doing much else. Although against Southampton, he did do a good job linking up play as well, which was nice to see. But it's a really positive run. I mean, obviously, everybody's heard now that nobody has scored as many goals as him through their first seven games at Arsenal. And currently I have this dream that he's going to overtake Alexis, because Alexis scored seven goals with Arsenal and he's got two now with United, which puts him at nine, and Aubameyang has six goals already. And if Aubameyang can finish with more goals than Alexis, I will just be over the moon with that. Just be the greatest
in half the time.
Yeah, exactly. The greatest form of poetic justice ever. So there's something to root for, something to watch for.
Yeah. He actually has the fifth best goals per 90 minutes ratio this season, of the four players that are better than him, Alexander Mitrovic and Henry Savert have played a combined 182 minutes of Premier League football. So basically, they're only there because they benefit from the anomalies that a small sample size produces. Essentially, there are only two players who have played any kind of meaningful amount of minutes that have a better goals per minute ratio than Aubameyang. Mohamed Salah, obviously, who has scored a ridiculous 1.06 goals per 90 minutes. I still maintain he's not actually that good, but his goal his goal ratio is absolutely outstanding. And then Sergio Aguero, who's at 0.96 goals per 90 minutes. Aubameyang, for reference, is at 0.89 goals per 90 minutes, which is outstanding. That's higher than Charlie Austin, who's 0.86, higher than Harry Kane, who's 0.85, and higher than Raheem Sterling, who's 0.67, who are the next on the list if you take out the kind of anomalies from small sample sizes. So really, he is in the elite level of goal scoring in the Premier League this year. Admittedly, he's only played, I think it's about 600 minutes, a bit over 600 minutes of football. 611 minutes of football. But he has proven over the last seven games that he is just a prolific goal scorer. He might not be a clinical finisher necessarily, but he just creates so many chances for himself with his movement that he's just going to score goals.
Isn't it great to get exactly what you wanted to get out of a player? I feel like Arsenal never do that. And this is exactly what we wanted from Aubameyang, and he's delivered, which is probably why there's not as much pomp and circumstance about it, just because this is what we expected him to do, and he's doing it.
Yeah, Granit Xhaka is a hard-hitting midfielder. Mustafi is a composed, dominant centre-half. It's incredible. Kolasinac's a bombarding fullback. I guess we got that, but only in spurts. It's amazing. You're right, we've got a player who is what he's Ron Seal. He does what he says on the tin. and he's doing it very well, and I think he's setting himself up ideally for next year, really. It's extremely frustrating that he can't play in the Europa League, but because of that, for Aubameyang, how many games has left? What, five, six games? Something like that.
I think five.
For him, really, those games are all about making sure that he ends the year fit, in form, and ready for next year. Acclimatised to his new club, has garnered an understanding with the likes of Mesut Ozil. Obviously, he's already got one with Mkhitaryan, but with Wobi and Ramsey and all of these other players, that he's starting to just feel really settled at this club, so that next year, that is then the season that he can really establish himself as one of the Premier League's top strikers.
I think one of the best things about it is, as we saw against Southampton, he didn't have Ozil or Mkhitaryan or Ramsey or any. He had Iwobi and Welbeck, which, I mean, again, we love these guys, but they are not exactly the kinds of people that I think Aubameyang came over here to play with. And yet he combined fantastic with Danny Welbeck. Them two look like best buds. It was a lot of fun to watch. And maybe I read too much into people's facial expressions on the pitch, but ever since Alexis threw his tantrums, I've kind of gotten in the habit of doing that. Aubameyang looks happy all the time out there, and I do take a lot from that. I mean, I kind of made the point that his goals are nice and all, but just seeing him happy there, I think, is a major point, because it's been such a tough season for this club, and to go from Alexis, who you're always watching and always dreading because you just know he's in a pissy mood, to seeing Aubameyang, who's just always smiling. It's really nice to see.
Yeah, just wait for a year, and when Real Madrid start calling and Arsenal have lost another game away at Crystal Palace, and Aubameyang slouching in the corner, dreaming of playing alongside Cristiano Ronaldo and Luka Modric. It'll come, I'm telling you. When it comes, we'll rewind episode 28 of the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. We'll mark my words. Is there anything else you want to talk about the Southampton game before we take a break?
No, not really. I think we got it all. Welbeck was great. It needs to be said. He was great.
Yeah, no, he did. And I thought Iwobi played well as well.
He did. He played really well. He created a lot of really convincing chances, which. I've
made this point previously that I think he just looks better without Mesut Ozil, because I think they just all like to be in the same position.
Yeah.
Him, Ramsey, Ozil, now Mkhitaryan. You can throw Jack Wilshere in there as well. They just all want to be in the middle. And actually, the beauty of Manchester City's team, for example, is that you have De Bruyne and Silva who want to play in the middle, but then you have Sané and Sterling who make the pitch absolutely massive because they stand so far wide. Arsenal have players like Silva and De Bruyne who want to play in the middle, but then they don't have any natural wingers. Whereas on Sunday, they had Reece Nelson on the right, who is quite happy to stand out there. They had Danny Welbeck in a kind of advanced left position, who's stretching the pitch. Aubameyang stretching the pitch. And Iwobi has all this space to work in the middle. And it's not a surprise to me that he does so much better in a system like that than when everything's really tight and congested and a little bit cramped.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's my 2 cents on Alex Iwobi. We will take a short break, and when we come back, we will discuss Thursday night's trip to Russia, which politically, tactically, and possibly humiliatingly will be not a nice... Is that a word?
It is now.
It is a word. Humiliatingly will not be a nice evening. We'll see you on the other side. Hello and welcome to the second part of the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. I'm with Josh and Henry can't be with us this week, unfortunately, but, you know, we'll muddle through with the American.
That's what I am to this show. I'm just that American.
The American, yeah. The one of... How many of you are there? What, 400 million or something?
Yeah, I think I'm the only one that likes Arsenal. I don't know. Something crazy like that.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Well, you're the only one who knows anything about soccer. So, That's the best I can do in terms of an American accent.
That's pretty convincing. That's all I've got. Very convincing.
Yeah, that's all I've got. Arsenal travel to Russia on Thursday under a cloud of controversy, both on the pitch and off the pitch. We will see what Arsene Wenger does with his team, but they go there with a 4-1 lead, and let's be honest, this is a game that they should be winning. Why do I get the feeling that they're not going to win it?
I mean, I guess the positive spin on that is that they don't have to. And obviously, we want to see them win. Yes. We want to see them do it convincingly and do what Henry predicted last week and score 5-0 or win 5-0. But I don't know. I mean, I'm in that state where I'm so not nervous that it makes me nervous, which is what Arsenal has conditioned me to do.
Yep.
Anytime it seems like there's no way it could go wrong, I start thinking of all the ways it could go wrong.
It could go wrong.
And of course, there are plenty of ways, but I'm not that worried. As much as Arsenal tends to Arsenal it up from way too often, they have too much quality out there, even with Mkhitaryan's injury, to really screw this one up. And I say that so hesitantly because all of the worst case scenarios are playing in my head like a slideshow. So, yes, that's my opinion on how we're of course not going to screw this up.
I think I think you make a good point there. Arsenal are well designed to play from the front. They're good on the counter attack. They can sit deep, and they can also have these long periods of possession that just kill the game. They can keep the ball for 4 or 5 minutes and not really allow CSK Moscow to get near to them, and that will really kind of if Moscow score first and then Arsenal proceed to keep the ball for 10 minutes. In theory, that can kill the game and really kind of limit the effect that, say, the atmosphere may have with it being an away game. They did in Milan, they have the ability to play to their strengths with a 4-1 advantage. The problem is that Arsenal are stupid, and Arsenal very rarely play to their strengths and play to their advantage. I think they will this time, but it wouldn't shock me if they didn't.
I just think it's funny because even after the Southampton match, they asked Arsene Wenger about the defensive mistakes, and he said, look, we're an offensive team. And I was like, very well put. However, there have been so many times like Östersund in the second leg where you just sat there and tried to defend, which is, as he admits, not our strong suit. And that's the only thing that worries me, is if they go into Moscow and they just try to park the bus, because we are not a team capable of parking the bus. And
no.
The more you try to do it, the more it's going to fail. So just stick it to them. Play like you did at home, where you just bury them and send everyone home happy.
Yeah, and also when you play that way, in terms of a very negative outlook on the game, if you do concede a goal and suddenly you would quite like to score, it's quite difficult to just, you can't just switch from being really defensive to suddenly trying to open up the game a bit and play a bit more in an attacking manner. It doesn't really work like that. You can't just turn it off and on. You have to kind of ease your way into the game and you have to play with confidence on the ball, and that comes with doing it regularly. Well, if you've just had 50-60 minutes of not really having the ball and now you're 2-0 down and people are getting a bit nervy, you can't just flick a switch and turn it on, and it wouldn't surprise me if Arsenal got into this rut where they just can't string passes together properly. They concede a couple of quick goals and suddenly the nerves begin to set in and Moscow start getting their tails up and they start thinking, oh, well, we could have them here. And you know, I guess it's kind of Monaco from a few years ago in the Champions League all over again, isn't it? But we will have to see. How do you think, specifically with this game, we discussed this prior in the podcast about for the whole season, but how do you think with this game Wenger will get around Mkhitaryan's impending absence?
I think you made a compelling point with Elneny potentially coming in to play, especially in a game where we just need to defend. Of course, then I worry that the point will be to just defend and not really have much else. But I could also see him going with Iwobi, just because I'm sure he still has so much faith in Iwobi to be on that same level as Ozil and Mkhitaryan. I don't think he'll go with Welbeck, just because Welbeck has had health issues this season and he's been doing so well in the Premier League, I mean, at least in this past week, that you don't really want to compromise that for the sake of if you have other options. I don't know. I think if I had to choose one, I think he'll just slot Iwobi in there and be done with it. Because you don't really have to, at least I hope he doesn't have to overthink what you do to protect a 3-goal lead against CSKA Moscow. I hope he just takes a sensible option and gets on with it.
No, I think that's what he will do. I think I would probably play Welbeck just because he's proven so many times away from home in a difficult European tie, he just has this knack of being an annoying attacker to play against. And you can actually push him up into a two alongside Lacazette and drop Ozil a little bit deeper and even go a little bit more direct, say, on the counter-attack when you've got two players up there. But I think it's a bit of a much of a muchness, really. I don't think it will have that much impact. It's only one player, and I think the rest of the team will be exactly the same as last leg, and they're in a pretty good rhythm with one another.
Yeah, I will say I would prefer to see Welbeck too, but the question was, what would Arsene Wenger do? So yep. I just wanted to clarify that.
And as we've said so many times,
there's a big difference.
What I would do and what Wenger would do are two very, very different things. Very different things.
But going back to what you're saying about it being only one player, I think we saw that against Moscow, because we had so many star performers in that game, and Mkhitaryan wasn't one of them. Which,
no.
I mean, obviously it comes and goes, and that's just the nature of the game. But it was promising to see that we can be that good with one player down. So,
and certainly you put Ramsey, Lacazette, and Ozil in the same team, and really, I think if Arsenal score, they'll be fine.
Yeah,
they're bad defensively, but they're not going to concede 4 goals, and it would quite difficult to see how they won't score with that attacking talent on the team. Eventually they're going to play the right pass or the right cross, or something's going to break right for them, and they will score. Well, he says. If Arsenal do happen to lose, what has to happen for that to be the case?
I mean, I think I touched on this already. Just if they don't go at this game aggressively, if they go at this game from the perspective of don't screw up, that's when they're always screw up. If you go in thinking, I can't mess up, you're going to mess up. If you just go in thinking, business as usual, let's just take care of it, you'll be fine. But it's whenever you start overthinking. And maybe that's why I'm not as worried, because when you got guys like Koscielny, I mean, they're anchors. Those are guys that have been here before. They know the right mindset to have going into a game. And that's why I'm not really that worried. The only thing I'm potentially worried about is if Wenger just completely loses all sense of reality and decides to really overthink this. And but I don't really think that's going to happen.
No, no, I think you're right. I think for me, what has to happen is probably Moskov to score quickly twice. So if they score, say I think they have to score early, but say they score in the first 20 minutes and then they don't score again until the 65th minute, I think even if they're 1-0 up at that point, I think Arsenal will be fairly comfortable. If they, like Östersund, score two goals in a couple of minutes, or if they score two goals in 10 minutes, we've seen this team unravel time and time again after they've conceded a goal. And it wouldn't be surprised me if the pressure of the situation, the atmosphere is going to be absolutely feverish, and it wouldn't surprise me if that began to get on top of these players.
They did that against Östersunds, but honestly, since then, it seems like they've learned from it, and they haven't. But again, this is another one of those things where I want to believe it, but there's that nagging in the back of my head saying, no, this is Arsenal. They don't actually learn things. But no, I mean, against AC Milan, we saw a very conclusive, I mean, fairly conclusive play, and I don't see why it would be any different now.
Yeah, I mean, the AC Milan one's a good example because they conceded a goal, and there was a couple of minutes where they went a little bit ropey, but they didn't concede again, and then after about 5-10 minutes, they settled down, and then they controlled the game from then on, and then obviously they went on to win. But they still conceded the first goal and still were able to dictate the game. I think had Milan scored again within the 5-10 minutes, then that would have been a very, very different tie. But the fact that Arsenal were able to ride that storm just for a few minutes and then settle in back into their rhythm again allowed them to control the game and then go on and win it. And I think the same thing's true here, that if they can get to half-time at 0-0, I'll be completely certain that they will go through, because there's no way they're going to concede three goals in 45 minutes. They're going to be able to control the game for these 5 minute periods where they have long extended times of possession. They're going to be able to kill the game over 45 minutes with the three goal advantage, you would hope. Let's play risky game and assume that Arsenal make it through. Do you think they can win the Europa League? Or do you think they are the favourites to win the Europa League even?
I do, actually. Even with Atletico Madrid still in there. I don't know. I still have this belief that when you put the pressure of a cup competition on Arsenal, they show up. And obviously, the League Cup didn't help that theory. But, I mean, we saw it in the FA Cup. They did it against Chelsea. We've seen it before. I do think they're the favorites, and I do think that there's an added pressure, not pressure, an added pertinence to win just because of the way this season has gone and the need to get back in the Champions League. I don't think they've had a need like this since that first FA Cup that they won after the 9-year trophy drought. And I mean, that wasn't the most conclusive game whenever they won that against Hull City, but but they still did dig deep and find a way to come back and win. And I feel like that's the state they're going to be in, assuming they make it all the way to the finals, and that's a really hard Arsenal to beat.
Yeah, no, I agree to an extent. I'll be very worried if they get drawn against Atletico Madrid in the semi-finals, because I think the leg in Madrid, whether it be the first or the second leg, will be hairy, to say the least. This is a team that aren't very good on the road. Madrid are very good at home. They have a brilliant atmosphere there. And it wouldn't surprise me if Arsenal, especially if it's the first leg, wouldn't be surprised if Arsenal lose 2 or 3-1 and suddenly you're quite concerned that it might be game over. Having said that, if they meet Madrid in the final, we've seen this team before. In 90 minutes, they are able to turn it on when it matters most. Like you said, in the FA Cup, when they beat Manchester City and then they beat Chelsea. I mean, they dominated Chelsea in that final. They were much the better team, and that was with Danny Welbeck playing up front.
And it cut Price to fit. It was like Mertesacker and holding back.
Yeah,
there, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Mertesacker holding, and was it Monreal as well? Or
yeah, Monreal.
So you know, they had severe injury problems, and they were the better team, and the better team comfortably in that game. And it wouldn't surprise me if they play 90 minutes against Atletico Madrid in the final when it really matters, when Wenger really needs it, and they put in one of those kind of stellar Arsenal performances. They press high up the pitch, they play really fluid attacking football, and they score a couple of goals. If it's in the semi-final, I'm far less confident, because I think over 180 minutes, there's a greater chance that defensive errors will be made, there's a greater chance that Madrid will be able to control the game a bit more, and maybe Arsenal's form might fluctuate to the extent that they have these 15, 20-minute periods where Madrid can score two or three goals and essentially end the tie. It is, I think you're probably right, the biggest trophy since the 2014 FA Cup win.
Yeah,
I can do my maths. Yeah, 2014 FA Cup win. You know, obviously that was a 9-year trophy drought, and it, thank God it ended. But I think, I genuinely think if Arsenal win, there's a very good chance that Wenger's going to stay. If Arsenal lose, I think there's a fairly good chance that Arsenal may actually sack him, which is remarkable, but I wouldn't surprise me if they decide to move on because there's no Champions League football. This is a huge trophy. Huge trophy. And it's only added to the fact that it provides a backdoor into the Champions League next year, which you're looking at the summer recruitment and what players Arsenal might be able to keep hold of. Will they be able to keep hold of Ramsey if they don't have Champions League football? It's highly doubtful. Will they be able to bring in some of the top players around Europe without Champions League football? They managed to get one or two this year, but I have a feeling they brought them in on the expectation that they'd be back in the Champions League next year. If they're not in the Champions League next year, suddenly players start to look at them and they begin to see a pattern of this is a Champions League-less team. They just don't. They're no longer in the Champions League with regularity, and that's not a team that I want to be playing in. This is huge for Arsenal.
There is
huge.
There is a kind of majesty to being part of Arsene Wenger's last hurrah, though, and I still think that does carry a lot of weight. Even if worst case scenario, we don't win the Europa League, we don't get Champions League football, but Arsene Wenger goes into these negotiations saying, "Look, this is my last year. I want to make one more go of the Premier League." I think that could still pull in a lot of big names.
Hopefully. I'm not quite as confident, but
I mean, obviously you never know. Biggest of big names, but I think you could get the, you could fill the needs that you have and maintain who you have, just because, I mean, he's really one of a kind at this point. There's nobody else out there like Wenger who has this experience, who knows this club, who cares about his club. And you hear people all the time still saying, the reason I came here was because of Arsene Wenger. I wanted to play under Arsene Wenger. And I think that still holds some weight. And granted, if he misses the Champions League and then stays on, extends his contract, obviously it's going to lose its magic. It's not going to work the same. Yep. But one last time, I think it
for one
it
more
could,
year.
Yeah.
Yeah, possibly. Possibly. I do think it would. Obviously, I don't want it to happen. But I almost want it to happen just to see what the fans' reaction will be to Arsenal not winning the Europa League, not getting in the Champions League, and Wenger staying. Like that's worst case scenario for the remaining few games of this year. If that happens and then Wenger stays, it would be a mess. I mean, Twitter would just be a minefield. Oh, I mean, it's minefield anyway. Well, yeah. But there we go. I think we're there, aren't we?
I think so.
You think so? Excellent. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll try and get to you after the Moscow game, probably on Friday, but we'll have to see what happens. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you're not as nervous as I am. I hope we don't have to cower behind the sofa, knowing that Arsenal are protecting a slender one-goal lead with 10 minutes remaining, because that's definitely not going to happen. You can find us on Twitter, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us at paininthearsenal.com as well. Go and search us out and read our stuff, and thank you very much for listening to our podcast. We will see you, hopefully, after a win against Moscow. Goodbye.